Jack, it's Bill.
Sprague told me what happened.
Curtis didn't leave you any choice.
That's what I keep trying to tell myself.
You did the right thing.
We need Assad alive.
He's on his way back. I think you should come in, too.
Tell the president I'm sorry. I can't do this anymore.
The hell you can't.
We're going to find that suitcase nuke because of you,
Jack. You've done great work today.
Good, then you don't need me anymore.
I'll send a car for you, Jack. Come back here. We'll talk.
I'm done. Boom!
I don't have a nuclear explosion sound effect.
You don't have the sound mushroom cloud, do you?
Best I could do. No, that sounds like you're spitting in the microphone.
Yeah.
That's
what nuclear bombs sound like, spitting into a microphone.
So that was the end of Hour 4 of 24 last week. Hour 5 will be tonight on Fox Channel 2 here in St. Louis. And I've got a guy on the phone with me from U.S. News by the name of Kevin Whitelaw, who's one of their senior writers, who did a piece not long ago about the real-life CTU. It's not called the Counterterrorism Unit like it is on 24. It's called the National Counterterrorism Center. You actually got in there and got to see all their cool stuff, didn't you, Kevin?
Well, you know, I was inside, although I'll tell you, it doesn't much look like the one you see in the television.
Oh, no.
Oh, no? Doesn't look like a Hollywood set?
No. Well, you know, actually, the interesting thing is if they for their operations center, the National Counterterrorism Center, they consulted Hollywood set designers as well as Imagineers from Walt Disney to try to help create something that both looked high-tech and functioned well. You know, what you don't have are the guys running around with the guns and seeming, full knowledge of everything going on everywhere inside and outside the United States.
Yeah, I want to know, is there an equivalent of Chloe who can sit at a computer monitor and call up a schematic of any building in the world?
Strangely enough, no. But what you do have in that office instead is for the first time one place where all these different databases from all the different law enforcement and intelligence agencies in the government, and there are a heck of a lot of agencies and a heck of a lot of databases. So we're talking about 32 different databases all piped into this one place. And it is the one place in the government where all this information comes together. And the analysts there, and it is just analysts there. There's no agents. There's no operators. There's no killers. But the analysts there can really go through and then sift through this information and try to find the hidden patterns and try to correct what didn't happen before leading up to 9/11 and sort of connect the dots.
And this was a central part of what needed to be fixed after 9/11 because there were all the complaints about all these different agencies you referred to not sharing information and there not being any place where the funnel was actually leading to, right?
Well, that's right, and especially bridging the gap between foreign intelligence and domestic law enforcement. And so what this really does is it brings together into one room, in fact, this big operation center, which looks just a little bit like Hollywood. It does really bring together this kind of information, which before was only sort of shared ad hoc and, you know, largely depended on the personal connections of FBI agents and CIA officers who happen to know each other and might call each other up on the phone and kind of catch as catch can. So this is a much more rigorous process where they try to keep what they call situational awareness perspective of what's going on all around the world and inside the United States as well, and looking for things that might seem out of the ordinary, that might be warning signs. So they've got, you know, intercepts coming in from the National Security Agency, you know, intercepted phone conversations or emails. They've got stuff coming in from CIA stations abroad. They've got FBI case files. They've got Homeland Security and Transportation Security Administration stuff. They've got, in fact, an unbelievable amount of information, and one of the biggest challenges is just making sense of it and figuring out how to process it all.
So if all that stuff is being channeled to this one central area at the National Counterterrorism Center, does that mean that the various agencies have learned to cooperate?
I wouldn't go that far. No, and in fact, what makes this unusual is it's about the only place where this kind of stuff does come together and happen. And what they've created is an open work environment where inside of it anybody can well, not anybody, but in theory most people can see just about everything. The difference, though, is that they're not allowed to just sort of unilaterally distribute information that's not sort of connected to their home agency. So that, you know, if you're an FBI agent, you actually, you know, working in the operations center, you've got access to raw CIA case files and traffic coming in from overseas. It's unprecedented. But you can't just sort of send them back to your colleagues at FBI to show them something. You got to go through some proper channels and work all that. And, you know, the other thing, it's not like you sort of press a handful of buttons and all of a sudden you've got all these different databases and you're running Google searches. There is no way to search all of these databases at once. You have to search each one of the 32 individually.
Well, that seems stupid.
And, in fact, they have, a lot in the operations desk. Each desk has in the operations center. Each desk has 9 different computers underneath it.
Oh my!
Toggle back between the different ones. Well, because all of these are individual networks run on proprietary systems that were never designed to be, operated together, and they can't talk to each other.
Is there talk that they might create software so they can talk to each other?
Eventually, that's the idea. It does take some time to sort of deal with this. These are huge systems. I mean, they're basically sort of think about the IT challenge. It's in some ways even bigger than any corporation has to deal with in trying to bring all of these different agencies' stuff together, all of it written along different specs to optimize different things. Old data, some of it dating back quite a ways. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on, and a lot of these agencies, the FBI in particular, have a horrible history of computer woes. And so, you know, you sort of put all that on top of it. They're still pretty far away from that. At the same time, there's just floods and floods and floods of information coming in, and so it really is an amazing struggle. One of the jobs they do in this center is they compile a list of suspected terrorists. Terrorist identities list, and so there's more than 400,000 names in this list of possible terrorists. Now, some of them are aliases, about 100,000 of those, so about 300,000 possible terrorist identities, and that forms the backbone for a whole bunch of lists, like the watch lists, like the no-fly list that's administered by other folks. But something like 5,000 to 7,000 names a day pour into the center from around the government. People nominating suspects to be on the terrorist list, saying, hey, you know, such and so, you know, John Doe it might well be a terrorist. I think he should be on the list. 5,000 to 7,000 names pour into the NCTC every day.
How can they possibly vet that much information and that many names that are coming in? This is one of the problems that privacy advocates have with the government having a database like the no-fly list, in that things end up on there for people who shouldn't end up on there. I mean, even congressmen have been banned from flying because their name matched the name of somebody who ended up on that list, and they can't find out what the reason was, and they can't get their name off.
That's right, and you know, the no-fly list is run based off of data created at, you know, and held at the NCTC, and so their job is to try to go through this. And you can imagine they have a huge team of people dedicated to doing this, just all day looking through these names, trying to figure it out. A bunch of former police officers and former military folks. It's hard. They do, you know, mistakes can get made. They have imperfect information, as one of the officials there said to me, you know, one of the biggest problems is trying to tell, you know, this Mohammed apart from this Mohammed.
Right.
And the kind of stuff they often get is, you know, Abu Mohammed from Baghdad is a terrorist. Well, you know, there's a couple of those.
Talking with Kevin Whitelaw from U.S. News here on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX about the real-life CTU called the National Counterterrorism Center. Tell me if this ever happens. They get information from one agency. Let's say it's a military intelligence agency about some guy in Baghdad or Kabul or the mountains of Pakistan who's really a bad guy, and they want to take him out. They have his location. They know he's trouble, and pretty much we've got to get rid of this guy. And another agency, the CIA or the NSA or whoever, says you can't take him out because he's an informant for us.
You know, I mean, the exact scenario, not sure, but what they definitely do is they try to deconflict their operations. And so where these agencies might not have been talking to each other. So, you know, in your example, the FBI might well have been, you know, a couple of years ago, if they'd gotten a tip, given it straight to the military, and the military might have gone, all right, great, we're going to hit him with a predator. Well, you know, if he was, in fact, a CIA informant, or if the CIA was tracking him to try to find, you know, if he was maybe a messenger for bin Laden and they were trying to follow him, you know, they might not have learned about it until it was too late. Here the idea is the top officials from these agencies dealing with the on the operational level, you know, meet every day by video conference under the auspices of the NCTC. In fact, they have three meetings a day for different levels of officials among all these different agencies, where they do just that kind of what they call deconfliction, where they try to make sure that everyone's working together, that there's no gaps, and that no one's stepping on each other's toes. And there have been times, there have been at least a handful of circumstances where something similar to your scenario has occurred, where they have been confronted with the question of whether or not to nab somebody or surveil him, and different agencies had different opinions about it, and they had to work and deconflict it. So,
Kevin, I've also heard and read stories about both the military and the intelligence community finding enough analysts with deep experience in Islamic culture who can really understand, and maybe if not going undercover, certainly sit at a desk at a cubicle at maybe the NCTC and be able to know what is really at the heart of a problem or what is going on. Is there a shortage, or has the NCTC ramped that up?
Well, I mean, there's a shortage across the government of knowledgeable experts when it comes to intelligence and law enforcement, especially ones that are able to deal with those kinds of various foreign cultures, particularly Islamic and Arabic speakers. It's a huge problem. You know, they say they're training them up, they say they're working on it, but it really is harder and harder. And in fact, these different agencies have been really competing with each other to try to figure out, try to get the best people. And so there have been efforts really in the past couple of months to tamp down that competition. And the CIA and NCTC have worked together pretty closely to try to figure out, all right, which terrorism analysts need to be where, so that we're both getting the, you know, that both agencies are getting their essential functions covered. So there is some of that.
So you got access, and you actually went in there and talked to these people, and you went into whatever the big room is that probably has more TVs than your average sports bar, I'm guessing.
They've got all the big screens, and what they say is they can basically pipe anything in there, and they get a little cagey about what exactly, and they had to bring it down to the unclassified level to let me in there. So they had the Fox News and the air picture, sort of the radar picture over.
And over here are a couple of YouTube videos. That's the level you're at.
Exactly. Well, they do pay attention to things like YouTube videos. You know,
really?
You laugh, but well, of course, because terrorists are increasingly using the internet to get their message out as well. And so, while it might not necessarily be YouTube itself, they watch the Islamic equivalents of that very carefully, because that is one of the many forms that these groups are now using to communicate. But they can definitely pipe in. They could pipe in predator feeds. They could be watching the skies over, wherever they've got drones flying. They could be piping in a number of different kinds of things where they can just track events, whether they're developing or whether they fear that they might develop. And so, they have a bunch of people from a number of, from all the different agencies. I in fact, spoke with a federal air marshal who was detailed to the National Counterterrorism Center, who worked in the operations room. So they have people from all around the government who come together. So you get a lot of people with very different kinds of training and different knowledge, all sharing stuff. And then what's very revolutionary is off on one side of the operations center, you have the CIA's own counterterrorism watch center. So their own independent unilateral CIA center is right on the side. There's no doors, there's no cipher locks, there's no vault. They're sort of right over on one side, and the FBI has its own on the other side. So here's a place where you sort of have been able to bring a number of different people together in ways that just had never even been conceived of before.
It sounds like a very cool place, and I hope that it's helping to make us safer. One last question for you. Having been in there, did it make you feel more nervous or unsafe, or less nervous and more safe about our world situation vis-a-vis terrorism?
It's a good question. And in fact, I asked a couple of the officials there, you when you see all this threat information all day long, does it make you paranoid? It really would seem like it could. And they sort of said, yeah, you got to guard against that. You get the sense that, all right, at least finally there's a place where they're really paying attention to all these kinds of things. But then you think about the sheer volume of stuff and trying to pick out the patterns, trying to pick out the one or two or three actual threats from the the dozens and dozens and dozens of threats that pour in there every day. I mean, the bulk of the stuff that they get are really, you know, people trying to carry out grudges against each other. Some guy doesn't like his neighbor and calls him in as a threat. It's that level of stuff that they have to sift through to get to the real threats. And the, you know, picking out that needle in the haystack, you know, man, that's tough work.
Trying to figure out which one's a Jack Bauer level emergency.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
I guess
when you need to dispatch the you know, the Jack Bauer team, because that team that team isn't in the NCTC. Though, you know, they don't do any operations themselves.
Gotcha, Kevin. It's terrific stuff. Thanks for the information. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
Kevin Whitelaw, senior writer for U.S. News and World Report, here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.